Stefan Faris was covering Darfur for Time magazine in 2003 when he realized that the conflict wasn't just about ethnicity, but there was an environmental component. It was the beginning of his exploration of the effects of climate change, and the result is his book, Forecast: The Surprising and Immediate Consequences of Climate Change. Stefan, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
When I started reading the book, it opens with Darfur and some of the climate change problems, but I thought Darfur was primarily about the Chinese buying up land for oil exploration. How does climate change fit into the conflict there?
Sure. Well, there's more than one conflict in Sudan, and I wouldn't say the Chinese have a direct involvement in any of them. The oil conflict is often considered to be a factor in the war between South Sudan and Northern Sudan, which is a long-standing civil war that has gone on for several decades. The Darfur conflict is actually a different conflict in that it's in a different part of the country. It's in the west of the country, and there it's very much, very clearly not a religious conflict. The South Sudanese conflict is often seen as being kind of Muslims versus Christians, but the people of Darfur are Muslims, just like the central government in Khartoum. But what it is somewhat of a lifestyle conflict. The two sides have kind of broken, and the way that these populations have gone has not been religious or ethnic or anything else. They say that they're Arabs versus Africans, but quite frankly, there's not really a big ethnic difference between them. It's more of a cultural difference. And the difference is between the ones who call themselves Arabs have been mostly herders, often camel or goat herders, and the ones who call themselves Africans have been mostly farmers. And so the conflict kind of started off when a long drought in the 70s and 80s started to degrade the lands that these two people were living on. So you all of a sudden you had a system where the farmers were able to kind of let their neighbors or their herders pass through. The farmers were sedentary and the herders were nomadic. And so the farmers would let them pass through and would kind of share their wells and let them feed their camels, say in what was left over from the crops after they had done the harvest. But when the rains failed, all of a sudden that wasn't working so much anymore. There was a perception that there wasn't enough land going around. The lands were failing, and so all of a sudden you had conflicts, and the farmers started to fence off their lands. And rather than let the herders come in, they'd actually burn the grass around their fields to make sure there was nothing to attract them. And so there you started to have these conflicts, this kind of land envy and divide, that when later on, when there was a rebellion against the government was able to come in and kind of fan the flames of ethnic divide into what we know as the conflict of Darfur today.
So primarily there was the drought that makes the land less productive, and originally it was seen as something that was caused by overgrazing.
That's right. I mean, there's little debate over the role of the drought in the conflict. The tie with climate change is a little bit tougher, because what people were thinking at first was this drought was actually kind of caused by the local inhabitants. They would graze their camels. That would change the reflectivity of the soil and disrupt the rain cycles. But some scientists in the U.S. using computer models kind of said, well, what if it was something else? What if it wasn't these farmers? What if it was something else? And so what they did is they took these climate models that scientists used to kind of get an idea of how the whole Earth's climate system fits together. And they fed in historical sea surface temperatures in the tropical and southern oceans, the same kind of sea surface temperatures that are could be causing stronger earthquakes, stronger hurricanes off the coast of the United States. And those same sea surface temperatures, according to these models, was enough to interrupt the African monsoon. If you kind of look at the map of Africa and the rain pattern over time, you have this kind of wave going back and forth up and down the continent over the seasons. And all of a sudden that wave was not reaching as far north anymore, wasn't reaching all the way up to the southern end of the Sahara where Darfur is, and so you had this long drought kick in. And so the conclusion, according to these scientists, was, well, Darfur, the drought there, is not really a random problem. It's not necessarily a driven by the local people. It's something that very well could be possibly driven by the emissions from our cars and our factories and our power plants.
And that changes the picture on what kind of responsibility people in the first world have to people in countries like this, doesn't it?
Sure. I mean, one of the people I interviewed for the book said it very nicely. He said this means we're no longer really in the position of being a good Samaritan trying to decide whether we want to get involved in this conflict. If indeed the emissions that we've produced are to some extent responsible for the drought and therefore to some extent responsible to the humanitarian disasters there, well then, like it or not, we already are involved. And so we have to decide to what extent we want to take responsibility for that.
Now, it seems like in a place like Darfur, there hasn't been any upside to the climate change. But another place that you visited that's seeing significant effects is Churchill. And some of the people there are actually seeing the changes as beneficial.
Right. It's Churchill, Manitoba on the Hudson Bay in Canada. And it was a port that was built kind of quite a while ago, but it was never really viable. There wasn't enough grain going up there. And not only was the reason there wasn't enough grain going up there is because the Hudson Bay is frozen. I can't remember what exactly it is, but something like all but 6 to 8 weeks out of the year. But already there, they say they're seeing the weather patterns start to change. The ice is breaking up earlier. It's forming later. And when I visited Churchill, the people managing the port there said that they were seeing that the port was able to be open for shipping maybe 2 or 2 to 3 weeks more every year, which doesn't sound like a lot, but you can see that if you kept on expanding that, all of a sudden some of the decisions that people are making as to where to send their grain starts to become place like Churchill starts to become more feasible, and also it allows the company who manages the port to invest more money because they get beforehand where you take a year-round port and you build, let's say, a crane to unload something. We get to use that crane all the whole year round. In a place like Churchill, you only get to use the crane when the ice isn't there, and so your investment there doesn't pay back as well. And so as the ice melts, all of a sudden those factors of availability and of capital investments become easier for them. They have a big advantage that, especially towards Northern Europe, the route's a lot shorter. If you leave from there, they can have deep water ships pull up right there in their port, as opposed to going through the locks and stuff in the Great Lakes. And so for them, it is an advantage, at least in the short term.
And I think that's the significant thing is in the short term. I thought one of the really interesting points in your book was where you said, we're looking at changes that are bigger than anything we've seen since basically this civilization began. And because we're looking at these sort of massive changes, we've got this whole infrastructure, we've got this whole cultural infrastructure too, that's based on things being pretty much the way they are. And what we're starting to see is the beginnings of that slipping. And it's changing the political landscape with the environmental landscape.
Sure. I mean, when you talk about it, to put in perspective, when you think of the last kind of big climate change that we as a human race have really experienced was the exit of the last ice age, from where we went to a world where North America and large parts of North America, large parts of Europe were kind of deep under ice. We're still seeing, you know, you can still see places where you see the boulders, the glaciers left behind, or the earth has been scoured in a certain way that you can see. And that degree, that difference, was around 11 degrees Fahrenheit of on average global temperatures, about 6 degrees Celsius. When we're talking about now climate change, we're talking about to continue warming from that in the same direction. So we're not going back towards an ice age, but we are again changing our average climate, and therefore we're changing the world with it. Well, since the last ice age, the last 10 to 12,000 years, basically, we haven't really experienced a jump of more than about half a degree Celsius or around a degree Fahrenheit in terms of how far we've shifted. Now, if you look at a map, the graph of global temperatures, you get these kind of way big ups and downs, and you get this tiny little squiggle of a very flat plateau. Those 10,000 years that we haven't seen much change yet, it essentially corresponds to the entire history of human civilization since the kind of development of mass agriculture. And so it just gives you an idea of that we've built our life on this very stable platform, and we're about to change that. And I think that's going to have kind of dramatic impacts as we go forward. On the far end of the projections, by the end of this century, we could be up 11 degrees Fahrenheit. We could be in a world that's at least the processes are set into motion to make it as different from where we are now as we are from the last ice age. And even if we do have complete success and set our goal now is about 2 degrees Celsius or 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit of warming, well, we're still talking a world that's dramatically different from anything that any kind of person from belong to our human civilization has ever seen.
I'm Marianne Barisonic, and my guest today is Stefan Faris, and we're talking about his book, Forecast, The Surprising and Immediate Consequences of Climate Change. So as the climate changes, people are forced to move. You're in Rome, so you're seeing in Europe this rise of right-wing groups that are sort of embracing environmentalism, but there's really the issue of immigration as people are starting to move. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. One way to think about climate change and the impacts of climate change is basically it adds uncertainty to our lives. So in that case, you get disrupted rainfall patterns that can lead to conflict, you get bigger natural disasters, you get flooding or whatever it is, and that in a sense disrupts things, or you get more health consequences. And a rich country like the United States or like countries in Europe, well, we have the infrastructure and the systems in place to kind of absorb some of those impacts. But poor countries don't have those, and so often for someone living on, say, at the very edge of what they're able to do, a change in rainfall can really mean the difference of your livelihood being viable or not. And so even though the impacts are going to be distributed largely equally, the people in the poor parts of the world are the ones that can be most affected. And so you're going to have an increase in the pressures towards immigration, towards the trend that we've seen already for many different reasons. Climate change will add another impact. So I came here, and looked at places in Europe where immigration is a big issue, just like the United States, and asked myself, well, you know, who's benefiting from this? And the answer is it's the right-wing political parties for whom immigration is an issue. In Italy here, you've got a group called the Lega Nord, who's they're certainly by American standards pretty far right on the issue of immigration. I mean, they're extremely exclusionary. They just recently managed to pass a law that criminalizes illegal immigration, makes it actually a jailable offense to be here illegally. And yet they've gotten a pretty good support from the people. They're an important member of the governing coalition. They control the interior ministry. Their signature issue is one that's very important in a country like Italy that basically hasn't had a great deal of exposure to immigration before and is trying to figure out where these new people fit into their society. I also went to the UK, where there's a political party called the British National Party, who are essentially an anti-immigration party as well. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to soften their image, and one of the ways they're trying to soften it is to talk about the environment sometimes. They talk about kind of protecting England's and kind of purity of its nature and so on. But often when they talk about the environment, what they're really talking about again is back to immigration, both because that's the way that kind of gets back to their core values, and also because it's a way to talk about, let's say, anti-immigration, which can often be seen as racist, in a way that doesn't seem to be so racist. So for instance, I spoke to a councilman who was also a mayoral candidate for London, and he was kind of talking about low-income housing, and he wasn't saying, you know, there's too many people coming here, too many dark-skinned people, or too many people from Eastern Europe coming to this neighborhood. He was saying the new housing they want to build is in a floodplain, and we shouldn't be doing that. So even though his issue was kind of really an immigration one, he was couching it in the language of environmentalism. And to me, what struck me was that same language kind of turned around and turned 90 degrees. You can hear from some of the green groups, the green groups that say, you know, we really need to be thinking about immigration for environmental reasons, are almost saying the same message as these guys saying, you know, we're really talking about immigration, but let's talk about the environment. So it has the potential to disrupt European politics somewhat and allow the Greens, some of the Greens who have historically been less leaning, a home in some of these more right-leaning parties.
So do you see this trend continuing, or is there any sort of growth in the idea that, as we talked about earlier, because the climate change is being driven primarily by practices in the first world, that we have an obligation to mitigate the effects in the poorer countries?
I think that message is starting to permeate among the negotiators of climate change treaties, but I don't think it's trickled down very much. One of the reasons I wrote the book, and one of the lessons I learned while I was researching the book, is that climate change isn't really about icebergs or about polar bears or about anything else. It's about people and the way that it impacts people. But I think that might be starting to change, but that really hasn't been the message most people are getting so far. Most people don't think it's climate change as something that we are doing that impacts people. They think about it as something pretty abstract. So the hope would be that we start to realize about that we're responsible for a lot of the things that we're seeing out there, but I don't think we're anywhere close to that yet.
Here in the United States, we think about the climate change as affecting people somewhere else. But when you were looking at the U.S., there are some specific things that are starting to be seen. And one of the things is the wine industry, which here in Oregon, it at least in the short run, could turn out to be a good thing for us.
That's right. Well, here's a way to think about wine. If you think about what makes a good wine, you basically have three different components, at least when it comes to the grape, which is a kind of the thing that allows you to make a good wine or not make a good wine. You have the grape itself, whether it's a Merlot grape or a Cabernet grape or a Pinot Noir grape. You have the soil in which you grow it, which is pretty static once you've got your property. And then finally, you have the weather that year, the climate. And if you think about what makes the difference between a good vintage, you know, a year that people talk about being as being a good year and the year that people talk about being a not so good year, well, the grape itself often hasn't changed. Unless something really drastic happened, the soil hasn't changed. What's changed between a good year and a so-so year is really just the weather that year, the climate. So as the climate changes, you're going to see changes of wine quality as you do on a year-to-year basis, except more consistently. And so areas that were once able to grow, say, Cabernet, might no longer be the best places to grow Cabernet. Areas like Oregon, which were on the margin of being able to grow Pinot Noir, which is one of the coolest grapes. No, apparently, I spoke to one farmer who 20 years ago was growing wine on his property and was really at the limit of what he was able to do. And he said most years, maybe 4 years out of 10, they would have a problem with the rains. The rain would come before the grapes were totally dry, ready to be picked. And so they'd have to pick early and the wine would be so great. He says now it's looking like that's almost not a problem anymore. So he says, you know, in his area in the Willamette Valley, the wine has already changed enough. The weather, the climate has already changed enough that it's been good for Oregon. In the short term, that's great. In the long term, it might not be so great. The people who are on the receiving end of this, in this case, might be the people in California who have been growing Cabernets, and all of a sudden it's getting warmer and warmer, and they're not able to grow Cabernets anymore. Well, what are they going to do? Are they going to change? They can do some minor changes. They can change the way the actual vines are trellised, the way they're actually arrayed to get different amounts of sun. They can plant on different parts of their property, on the north side of a slope that gets less sun, or they can start shopping for a new property if they really want to grow a Cabernet, or if they can uproot their stock and plant a wine that does better in a warmer climate. So you do have these impacts. I mean, we don't think of climate change as necessarily impacting our dinner table, but it may have done so already. I mean,
And I'm sure the wine industry is just one aspect of it, because we have all kinds of crops that have historically been planted in one region that now are going to be moving further and further north.
No, that's right. I looked at wine because it was something that a lot of people do care about, and also because it's a kind of a uniquely sensitive to climatic changes for the reasons I've already discussed. But it's going to happen all over the place. Particularly with more of the horticulture, with fruits and vegetables that maybe were more sensitive to swings in temperature than, say, some of the grains. I know that I haven't looked at this very closely myself, but I know that gardeners seem to have a pretty good understanding for what crop grows and for what plant grows in which part of the world, and they apparently have started updating their books already as well.
And another effect that we're seeing here in the U.S. is being reflected in the insurance industry. Can you talk a little bit about how insurance rates are related to climate change?
Well, if you think about what the insurance industry does, is its job is to take risk and rechannel it. And while scientists are still, to some extent, debating to what extent climate change means, say, stronger hurricanes, the insurance industry is saying, well, you know, we've seen enough that we're convinced that there's a stronger risk, or at the very least, we don't know what the risk is, and we're getting more worried about offering our product. And so especially in the years after the year after Katrina, and then the year before Katrina was a particularly strange storm year, you started seeing insurance companies pulling out of markets altogether, or raising rates if they did have to stay, or especially in the commercial industry, which is less regulated than the residential industry, they would just kind of either only accept partial coverage, or they would raise their rates astronomically. And what I concluded is that, you know, people in places like Key West where I went, or in places like New Orleans where I went, if they they're seeing higher bills, and so therefore this might be one of the few places that where we're already kind of taking climate change and putting a monetary cost on it. These people are actually getting, in a sense, in their higher premiums, are getting a bill for climate change that we're all contributing to, but they're the ones receiving it. And of course, that's going to be the same thing for people, say, in California with the wildfires, or people in the Southeast with flooding. As climate change kind of is expected to, some people say, weird the weather to make it more dramatic weather, more common, you're going to have harder times finding coverage for those types of events. And when you do have it, they'll be more expensive because the insurance industry is going to be using their models and saying, if it's more dangerous, well, we can't afford to cover you for what we used to cover for. We need to charge you more.
Right. But at least in the short run, in some places, the government is stepping in and subsidizing the insurance industry.
Sure. No, in Florida, for instance, they, particularly with RIN coverage, my understanding is that it was the government was essentially taking on that whole risk. And politically, it's hard to raise taxes. It's hard to raise insurance rates when you're the one providing it, when your elected officials are the ones providing it for you. And so certainly in the years after Katrina, it may have changed now because they've had a few years of no storms, but certainly the years right afterwards, there was the risk that if you had a big storm like you did in those years, Florida could very easily bankrupt itself just because it was not charging a rate that was able to cover the cost of if it did take a hit. So the government does step in, but if the risk really is raised more and you're not charging enough to cover that risk, at some point somebody has to pay. And if it's not going to be the policyholders, it's going to be the taxpayers who have to bail out that government.
Right, and then that could be one of those effects that suddenly changes, because if the government is subsidizing the insurance industry and people are going along figuring that everything's taken care of, and then there's a huge hit and the government goes bankrupt, all of a sudden people are going to be hit with things that they hadn't been expected to see. So instead of seeing like a gradual rise in the insurance rates that kind of drives people to places that are less prone to the storms, it seems like lack of planning is going to make a large dislocation happen.
I mean, it certainly could. We're talking, in this case anyway, about state governments being bankrupt rather than the federal government, but just make that clear. But New Orleans is a perfect example of that. I mean, you had, in a sense, people living in a place where they didn't think the risk was as high as it was, and all of a sudden you had an actualization of the risk. And since then, I mean, lots of people there have had a hard time buying a new home. The people who had basically paid off their home, they had this problem. The insurance company was often allowing them to at least pay back part of it, but they had to take a mortgage out. But then when they went to get insurance on this new house, the insurance companies were saying, well, we don't really want to insure you for that and unless you pay a huge amount. And, of course, without the insurance, they couldn't get a mortgage because no bank would give a mortgage to somebody who wasn't able to insure their house. And so often people were being faced with these bills, insurance bills, that were bigger than the price of their mortgage. I spoke to one guy in New Orleans who had lost his house. He had during the flood. He had bought another one, and he was moving again. His property taxes had gone up because fewer residents meant that the city had to kind of distribute its tax base among fewer people, so his property taxes had gone up. He'd expected that, but then his insurance bill started going up, and he just realized, you know, I just really can't make these payments anymore. He says, you know, the first time I had to evacuate New Orleans, it was because of the flood. Now I feel like I'm evacuating again, and this time it's because these insurance rates have shot up, and that could obviously happen in other places as well.
Because the problems are so large and so widespread, it really does have to be something that the government takes care of. And, I mean, we're seeing some hopeful things in the Obama administration because the Bush administration was so bad on climate change issues. Do you see anything that the Obama administration's doing being terrifically effective, or are we just kind of making small steps that in the long run aren't going to make a difference?
Well, the hope is like anything else, whether it's healthcare or climate change or anything else, it's very difficult to pass legislation that solves the problem in one fell swoop. There is a bill in the House that's been passed that seems to at least take a stab at solving the problem. The Senate's considering it now. It would be nice if they were a little bit more robust and tackle this problem stronger, but often the first step is to get something in place that you can then start to make changes to. I guess where I'm particularly disappointed is I was hoping to have a better outcome at the international talks here in Europe and in Denmark next month. But it seems that those are not going to happen, and part of the reason it's not going to happen is because the Senate has not been able to pass a climate change bill that would give U.S. negotiators enough kind of proof that they're able to deliver to get developing countries on board, which then the Obama administration could come to the Senate and say, listen, we're not doing this by ourselves, please ratify this treaty. So somehow it's a very complex jigsaw puzzle that they're having to deal with. They've had to pick up the ball when the ball hasn't been moved for 8 years, and I think there was some hope 9 months ago or a year ago that was all going to come together, but it seems like it's not coming together right now.
Do you see a big difference in the way the mass media in the U.S. and the mass media in Europe is dealing with the climate change issues?
You know, I'm not sure I do. It depends a lot where you look and which publications. I think certainly in the past, the U.S. has been a lot more muddled about the message. There's been a lot more questioning about it. There's a lot of that happening in Europe as well. What's interesting to me is that in Europe, I've actually found that the elite class kind of is, let's say, the people making the policies are really on board. Let's say
Do you think that's because
it hasn't necessarily trickled down to the people? In the U.S., it seems to be often the policymakers are the ones that are actually holding things up, while the people have a better idea of what's going on.
Do you think that the reason that the people in power in Europe are kind of getting on board with climate change is because they've actually seen that this is a huge problem, or is part of it that if something like the carbon trading gets going, that there's actually a lot of potential for profit there?
Well, no, I think I'm not sure about this, but my guess is that the Europeans are simply more used to working in an international framework. I mean, they're these relatively small countries that, to get anything done, have to work together. And secondly, especially in say the northern countries, there are countries that are much more useful to handing over responsibility and authority to their governments, and so it's much easier for them to come out and say stuff. In the U.S., where we're a very individualistic system, we're very conservative, in a sense, by conservative I mean slow-moving government, and we have a distrust and a reluctance to hand over authority to government. I think it's a much more difficult calculus, and also we're just simply, you know, we're not that used to or that fond of working in multilateral systems.
Okay, well, Thank you very much. I'm Marianne Barasonic. I've been talking with Stefan Faris about his book, Forecast, The Surprising and Immediate Consequences of Climate Change. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me on.